Hey everyone, it's Rich. You know, they say that repetition builds retention. And there's no doubt this is true. But when it comes to acquiring knowledge, it also helps when the repeated message comes from different sources in different ways. In other words, this podcast can't always be just me preaching the same old lines. Although I admit it does seem that way a little more often than I would like. In this episode, I spent some time with Paige Hansen, someone who for the last 10 years has been helping both individuals and businesses navigate the increasingly complex and dangerous world of cyber safety and cybersecurity. She developed her passion for this endeavor while working at Norton LifeLock. Today, she is the co-founder at Secure Labs, a company that helps organizations negotiate the difficult landscape of governance, risk, and compliance. I don't really have an elaborate story to tell this time, no great metaphor to segue from, just a simple introduction to an inspiring person who's been dedicating her life to making the online environment a little safer for all of us. You're listening to Privacy Files. This episode is brought to you by Anonymy Labs, makers of MySudo, the world's only all-in-one privacy app, and Sudo Platform, the cloud-based platform companies turn to for seamlessly integrating identity protection solutions into their software. And have you heard about the MySudo web browser extension? Breaking your online data trail just got way easier. To learn more, visit MySudo.com. That's MySudo.com. Paige, welcome to Privacy Files.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, awesome. Great to have you. So you're a speaker on topics related to cyber safety, digital safety, identity, cyber threat landscape, teen online safety, lots of cool topics that we talk about here on the show. And you're also the co-founder of Secure Labs. Maybe you can tell me a little bit about what you do at Secure Labs.
Yeah, Secure Labs is a company we've built to help other companies, small to medium-sized businesses, organize all their governance, risk, and compliance efforts. So think privacy policies, the tech that you use, if the company is trying to get maybe SOC 2 attestation report or in healthcare HIPAA compliance related to HIPAA, their policies and procedures. We become an extension of their team. We help them with that. So a valuable team player in all things governance, risk, and compliance for our company.
We've talked a little bit about the GRC on the show, and that's really one of those areas, I think, where it seems like some companies get ahead of themselves and they just go implement a tool and they haven't really laid out the strategy for how they're going to tackle cybersecurity.
Well, yeah, I mean, the privacy policies and the policies you have written need to go hand in hand with the actual things that you do, whether it's the procedures that you do or the tech. That is, you know, the line with the tech. And we do see that. We see it's kind of fragmented within an organization. They might have, you know, five different tools that kind of overlap with each other that not aren't necessarily complementary to each other, but they are, you know, and so it's just almost having an outside perspective on what do you actually need. Then do you have the policy to back it up? Because, you know, at the end of the day, if a company has a breach, if a company has maybe a corrupt employee that's, you know, giving out, however the breach occurs, you need the policies in place, because whether it's your cyber risk insurance, whether it's if it's HIPAA and it's the governing body there that's going to look to see what you have. If you have an auditable trail of these documents, that's going to either lessen your fines or, you know, not raise your premiums too much. But you can't be negligent in the entire process.
What is the most common type of breach that you've seen in a company? Is it somebody internally makes a mistake, or is it, some really intelligent hacker finds a way to break into the system, or is it social engineering?
I will say it's across the board. I mean, more times than not, it's going to be as simple as, and I say simple just because it's the way that they're getting it, it's the phishing email. So you can do, you know, all this awareness training, which is great. You need to, and it's part of the requirements for many of the certifications and security certifications you might receive. But if security first isn't part of your culture and you're rethinking, you know, clicking on this link, or you don't have a way to just forward an email, a suspicious email, to just double check within your organization, you're going to have a lot of times your employees clicking on the links, or you're just doing your job. You're processing invoices. And you get a fake vendor and you end up paying them. You know, whatever the scenario is, usually it's going to be the entry point into your employees, and it's via the phishing email.
I hear a lot about the training aspect, of course, especially when it comes to identifying social engineering attacks. How important is it during the hiring process to identify and really vet out somebody to, I guess, ascertain if that person is trustworthy? And do you really think, they're taking company's best interest at heart? Because once you have them on board, it's kind of hard to fix those bad habits. And if there's a way to identify that during the interviewing process, I would imagine that would be super helpful for companies to avoid breaches.
Right. That's a really interesting question. And I take it in the approach of, there's the things that we have in place. You have the background checks, which is standard. You've got maybe an additional checks that you do within your company. Okay. So from your credit history, your work history, you call on maybe on their previous employees or references. Okay. We've got all of those lines. But I think that's why you're seeing a lot of companies going outside that traditional bubble. They're checking social media. They're even going to the next extent of checking your like Cash App, Venmo, those transactions, PayPal. Think about this, Rich. So we transfer money with our friends and family probably weekly, if not, every other week for something. And if you have it on public, but you think you're being funny and you send maybe like a grass emoji, okay, I wasn't born yesterday, right? Or you send and you have something funny. You're like, haha, thanks for the good time, right? And you're funny because it's between me and you. It's between me and my friend. But if it's a public, I can see any transaction that you do. So we're hearing of employers even taking that next step of how can we, okay, people scrub their social media. They make it private. We can't really see it. But you know what they don't do? They don't have their peer-to-peer payment systems also then private. So I always have mine private, even though I'm paying for, paying somebody back for dinner or something. But you just never know. But then they also know who you communicate with, who's in your circle. And then I even think just from a fraud, I put my fraud hat on for everything. I can socially engineer you. I know that every Sunday you pay so-and-so, or even your kid's babysitter or, whatever it is. And then you can easily social engineering them that way. So to answer your question, I think that the companies are looking outside the traditional. Yes, they're going to do the background check, but they're going to look for other ways to just see more about your integrity and more about you.
Yeah, I know my dad told me many times about the story that he went, the process that he went through when he was getting his top secret security clearance in the Air Force. And, they interviewed like his high school, his elementary school teachers, gym teachers, coaches that he played with in high school. And it's almost like you've got to really treat it that way because the stakes are so high now when there's a breach. And how much is at stake in terms of reputation, obviously lawsuits, regulatory fines? It's a big deal. And so I think it would make sense to me on the hiring front that companies really need to take that a lot more seriously to determine, okay, Are these people I can trust with all of this data? Which, it's not like the old days where you had a warehouse and all this physical property sitting there, and you had loss prevention security walking around. But in many cases, that data is worth even more than those warehouses full of inventory.
No, exactly. And even from a hiring standpoint, because a lot of roles are virtual, you have. Maybe you want to hire within the United States or a certain area of the world. Well, you have people that are outside the U.S. trying to get roles that are in the U.S. So they might VPN in, or they might be just something where everything is virtual. And so, or if you heard about that, was it known before, hired a North Korean hacker accidentally because everything was virtual. It all checked out. But it's almost like you need to do, yes, their ID might match their face and their location. They say they're from a certain city, but you almost have to take the extra step as a company to really confirm where they're going. The address they gave you, is that just like a central mailing pickup? you know, in some random city, you know, that you could do the reshipment fraud where somebody picks it up and then they ship it to whatever country it is, the laptop. So that's an additional check that I've even heard of companies going above and beyond if they want to hire within, you know, the US or a certain geographical region to confirm that the person actually is in that area.
Paige, how did you get started in cybersecurity?
Well, I think many people's stories, at least in I don't know, our age bucket, almost begin with an accident. You know, it's an accidental, it just happened. You know, I have a degree in, originally is in corporate communications and originally from Iowa. So when I moved to Arizona, I luckily, through networking, started at a company called LifeLock. So identity theft protection. And it was one of the first companies proactively going out there to not only protect your identity, but then to have their resolution services. So I grew up in this identity theft, cyber safety, cybersecurity industry as it was growing in this sector. And so with that, I, growing up in that, had a lot of opportunities to explore different areas in tech and different areas in cybersecurity. So all of the skill set I had prior to that just complemented the work that I got to explore and now continue to do.
And how did you get started doing the speaking rounds for on the topic of cyber safety?
You know, we had a number of programs internally at Norton LifeLock, and part of the deal was we have to go out and educate. And I was in public affairs at the time. And so developed a training program for law enforcement because we were getting a lot of victims of identity theft coming to us after the fact at LifeLock saying, okay, we're a victim of identity theft. We went to go report the crime to law enforcement. They told us that they couldn't help us. It was outside of their jurisdiction. There wasn't much they could do. So we, as a company, took on the initiative to, let's train the front line of defense. If they didn't have the proper training, let's do it ourselves and we'll find the experts and we'll develop that. So for over 10 years, we educated law enforcement, almost 20,000 law enforcement across all 50 states, including, oh, darn, I had to go to Hawaii, you know, one of those things. Toronto, we got to go to Guam, those sort of things. Law enforcement's all over. And it was extremely helpful. And that is where the public speaking came for, doing those trainings, sawing the impact that was truly making in the communities, because we'd also do community presentations, computer clubs, you name it. I mean, hundreds of speaking events from two people to, you know, 500 people and just really developed. I loved that sense of helping people. And so the kind of the more joy I kind of felt around that, the more I took initiative to find speaking events and opportunities to spread the word about cyber safety.
Let's take a quick break for this message from our sponsor.
All ready to check out?
Yes, I loved the new summer collection.
It's so good, right? Before I ring you up, were you interested in joining our loyalty program for future discounts?
Oh yeah, that sounds awesome. How do I sign up?
Awesome, I can sign you up right now. I just need a few things from you.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay, first thing I need is your...
Full name.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Sorry, I just need your...
Full name.
Oh, okay. It's Anna Paulus.
Perfect. Next thing I need is your...
Phone number.
Excuse me?
Sorry about that. What's your...
Phone number.
Do you really need that for my account?
I really need your...
Email.
On second thought, I think I'm good on the rewards program. Thanks, though.
You never know what will happen with your personal information. Next time you want to get the discounts and rewards, use a MySudo phone number and email to receive the benefits without compromising your privacy. Download MySudo today and have peace of mind knowing your personal information is secure. To learn more, visit MySudo.com. That's MySudo.com. Stay private.
And so after doing this for quite a while now, what would you say... What is the answer? Is there a magic bullet to all of this? Is it a combination of regulatory environment changes to self-help, if you will, you know, getting people more educated about the things that they can do to better protect themselves, better company governance? You know, what is the answer to this? Because I had somebody on the podcast a few months ago who career-long cybersecurity professional, probably 35, 40 years. And he was like, Rich, he's like the big paradox right now is like we're spending more money than we ever have on cybersecurity, yet there's more data breaches than ever. It's like, what's going on?
I think on the other side of that, we're collecting more data than ever. I mean, from the toothbrush that you use all the way, you know, you go to the doctor, you want a rewards points. There's data, even data that you don't even know. The new vehicles are collecting all of this data about you. If you're going through a toll, there's data about you. I mean, that's connected to your driver's license. I mean, it's just all connected because for good. But then depending on the skill set of the fraudsters over here, they're going to use that against you. So I wish there was a silver bullet, and I'm sure this is similar to other guests. It's a combination of everything that you mentioned, but from a consumer standpoint, it's all about layers. You have to create the layers in between your personal information and what the fraudster could potentially do and get access to them. And what I mean by that is, we'll take your username and password, good old username and password. You probably have 200 of them, different combinations of usernames and passwords. We've heard of breach after breach after breach compromising passwords. If you don't have at least multi-factor authentication, that extra layer, and you'll hear experts say, oh, don't do SMS and oh, don't do this. It's like, it's a layer. It's can SMS, yes, can somebody take over your phone and get a hold of your SMS authentication code? Absolutely. But to the average person, it's a layer that is going to protect them and their account. And that's the difference between your banking account being totally drained and you getting notified that somebody is trying to access your bank account. But what I think is tricky is that all of these notifications that have been put in place for the good, now the fraudsters are using those against you. Notifications from USPS. Oh, your delivery is coming. Notifications from Target, your Target pickup orders. Notifications from for me, it's like I get Ulta's having their 21 days of beauty. Do you think I click on that email? No, I go directly to Ulta's website and I see the beautiful, wonderful products available to me at 50% off. Okay. So it's those sort of things that you just get in the mode of these notifications are here to help you, but fraudsters are taking advantage of that and then sending fraudulent texts with links in there that are then compromising your information.
Yeah, things have gotten more complicated for sure. I sometimes get frustrated because I'm just trying to do something simple. I'm like, how many different things do I have to do just to get access to something that's mine anyway? And yeah, but then again, it just takes one little mistake or oopsie, and there you go. And you've just lost a bunch of data and money and who knows what. But I think too about all these smart homes, and there's some people that go all in on them. And every one of those devices, of course, is communicating with the internet. And you've got to be like an IT professional to manage that. And people don't have that in their house.
No, it's hard because you should technically, even just from a Wi-Fi setup, you should have your Wi-Fi that you and your family members use. Some people have gone to the extreme of saying, this is me and my spouse, and then my children are on one, guests are on another, and then all connected devices are on another. So, even that thinking like, what do you mean I need four different Wi-Fi access points? You just think because, so when you get in that, you just in that conversation alone of connected devices, giving guests a separate access, booting people off of your Wi-Fi once they leave. These are all things that become very overwhelming to the average person, even me just saying them, all of the steps. It becomes really overwhelming to think that you, in order to do that, that's what keep you secure. But fine, if you're all you and all your connected devices and all your guests are on the same Wi-Fi network, okay, we'll talk about that part later, but at least change the default password to these connected devices. If there was a breach of the passwords, or if some bad actor was able to get in with the password that was somewhat compromised, then at least you've changed the password to something different than you would use anywhere else.
Now, you also talk about AI. How can you get away with a conversation that doesn't include AI?
Right? Yeah.
How does that play a part in this space?
AI is, brilliant. We're making apps and coding things quicker than ever with the use of AI. Our lives are getting a little bit more simpler, I should say. I'm using air quotes right now, in the sense of, creating, whether you're creating social content or you're trying to plan a trip, you're having to put less effort in really researching. However, the flip side of this, you have the fraudsters who at one point you had to have a pretty strong skill set to make sure to deploy some of these attacks. Now, with the use of AI, if your English isn't that great, doesn't matter. If you're just an entry-level fraudster, this is your weekend game, you know, whatever, after 5 o'clock game, doesn't matter. There are tools available. You can easily use AI to, you know, perfect your message. And so it's making it so much harder for consumers to really identify what a scam is, what's not, what's real. And then a lot of people just end up throwing their hands up.
Let's take a quick break for this message from our sponsor.
Most people don't realize the weakest link in your digital privacy is your inbox. Deep down in the dark corners of the web, there are live auctions occurring.
Hey, over here, we got a phone number for sale right here, and over here, home address. Hey, wait, don't leave, come back.
I have the best list of usernames and passwords available. You want it? Come talk to me, I'll give you a fair
pass. I have credit cards over here with the security number. They've all been tested. No, I'm being
serious. I got a full name and birthday combo right here, people. Who wants it? That's full name, birthday combo.
Yes, your personal information is being auctioned off, often without your knowledge. Every time a company experiences a data breach, your information could be up for grabs to the highest bidder.
Sold.
With Reclaim, you take your first step towards taking back control of your digital privacy. Reclaim works in three steps: scan, discover, remove. Imagine a world where you're in charge of your own privacy, where your information can be taken back. That's the world Reclaim helps create. To learn more, go to anonymy.com/reclaim and start your journey towards better privacy today.
And, you know, one of the questions I always ask guests who've been in this business for a while is how is your profession in this space of cybersecurity, cyber safety, how has that changed you in terms of making you, let's say, more vigilant about how you manage your own personal data?
I think you should be interviewing my husband. How annoying am I? Was that the question? Am I hearing that right?
Sure.
No. No, I mean, just actually right before we were talking, Rich, I had a text message from my sister-in-law who had a coworker who was part of the recent breach. What do I do? And so what it makes me is my guard is definitely up more than often. Especially the law enforcement twist in my career, seeing not only the victim side, but just the number of scams and real life scams happening. And it's not just like a Law and Order SVU show where it's all solved in an hour. I mean, people's lives have been affected for the rest of their life, or it's years going on. Somebody buys a house in your name, whatever it is. So I'm just, a lot of forms I'm not putting in my real name, not my real birthday. Forms, let me see, like you go to a jump place and they, I don't know, want you to fill out your information. A rewards card, you're not getting my real birthday. I'll use a separate phone number my pseudo. I should actually, I'm going to look into this, but for the rewards card, you know, those sort of things, it's just like you are just more aware of how your information can be misused. So I think it's made me just definitely more vigilant in asking questions. I have no problem asking questions, going to a doctor. Why do you need this? Is there any information? Of course, I'll be lovely about it, right? But like, why? Why do you need this? What are you doing with this? If I don't like it, then I'm not going to provide it. So you got to remember, it's your personal information.
Yeah, it happens all the time when I go shopping, and you know, I'm about ready to pay, and before I pay, they're like, "And can I have your number?" Why?
Because you're going to save 10%, Rich. But I will say, here I've been in this industry for almost 20 years. And I never really had a break from it all. But when I had my child and I was out for about 6 months, it was the first time I had really stepped away from being just actively involved in all things cybersecurity, kind of tech. And I did find myself getting a little bit more lax with filling out forms. Not really. I'm like, I need to just get the service or get the whatever it is. And so I can see why, if you're not in this industry, it's harder for you to care as much because it's the convenience versus security. I'm not saying I went all rogue. I think that was just a refreshing revelation, because it helps you communicate to others that aren't in this industry and why you should care. Getting to that, the why, because I can tell you till I'm blue all these things that could go wrong and here's what you can do to help protect yourself. But until there's a why and how it's going to change your life and affect you, it's not probably not going to make a change.
I think what's helpful, and you know, we always here at Anonymy are thinking about ways to tackle this, but there is this massive hidden data economy that's taking place that really isn't transparent to people. And so you can understand why it's like, that's just some information. What are they going to do with it? Because they don't see all that stuff that's going on.
And that's the information that I'm giving away, because I'm going to get, you know, a free cookie on my birthday or a massage or, you know, whatever it is. What about the information? That's a service exchange, or I'm getting something. What about the information that you willingly just put out there on social media?
Yep.
So tell me this. So have you seen the surveys that people will take and they say, oh, this will be fun. This was my mascot. This is where I grew up. It was my first car. Here's my first boyfriend. Here's the all this. And it's like, cool. Well, you just gave away, if you answered them correctly, which I don't, but if you just gave away all of your security answers or all your questions, and I can easily use that to social engineer my way into probably any account, because you've just posted it for everybody because it was fun. It was fun.
And this is good timing too, because next month, Cybersecurity Awareness Month, in October. And there's a lot of stuff that's going on in the news. And I know before we started recording, I was talking about the Pavel Durov arrest, the CEO for Telegram. And I know we haven't been talking about encrypted communications apps, but it's definitely closely related. And it makes me wonder, in the regulatory environment, if you had any opinions on this, about where do you think the mindset is right now, at least in the West, in terms of how much patience the governments will continue to have with encrypted communications and not having that back door, if you will, the decryption key to get in to see everything that Paige is talking about?
I think this is difficult because there's a fine line between, you know, people wanting their privacy, but then a lot of legitimate reasons why you would want it encrypted. I mean, I do work, or I used to do work with NOVA, the National Organization for Victim Advocacy. You're a victim of a domestic violence and you're trying to get out of a situation and you need encrypted communication for your safety. That, absolutely, right? But then you've got somebody using an encrypted communication then for nefarious purposes. So naturally, law enforcement is going to want access to that data. And if you don't have a back door, you're not giving it up. It doesn't fall under a specific statute or regulatory law that you have to provide whatever information you have, it gets a little tricky, and it's a gray area. And that's when governing bodies come in and they'll make a point. They'll make a point with a certain company. They'll make the arrests. Where does that leave the rest of the companies that do exactly the same thing or similar? It probably leads them to getting outside guidance and counsel from their legal teams on, you know, where do we live in this lane that has not been having a speed limit sign? We're driving this same road over here. What do we do? And the fact that, you know, executives are getting arrested can make it really tricky for the C-suite right now. I don't have an answer. I guess I'm just saying it's just really tricky to navigate.
Yeah, it's certainly generating a lot of conversations as of late. And I was just thinking too that, I mean, Gmail obviously is a huge, huge tool that lots and lots of people use. And you know there's bad things taking place on Gmail, but you know, you don't see the executives getting arrested for that. So it's just going to be interesting to watch how this plays out, because this definitely does impact this space.
Absolutely, it does. And it also... Okay, aside from the C-suite being held accountable for a lot of things happening on in apps, but then your customer trust also fades when you say you do one thing, but then you do have a backdoor, or you say you do one thing and you're selling their personal information, you know, whatever it is, you lose customer trust. And that's it. You know, we both are part of companies that, you know, you need the customer trust, and that's how you build your brand loyalty. And so when you lose that or it's in jeopardy, that even makes the whole situation even trickier.
I know you've also given some talks on online teen safety. That's a tricky one too, because, you know, they're not adults. They're still kind of navigating their way in life, trying to figure things out. And so, especially today, that generation has not known anything other than the internet. So they've kind of lived mm-hmm. their lives online anyway, and they don't really see the trade-off because they didn't have a life prior to the internet when people were to some extent more private. How do you navigate that topic?
So this might seem obvious, but it's all around the whatever you post online is there forever. Kind of, you know, the things that you tweet, because they had Twitter at 12, 13, 14, that person, that teen that you were, when you go and get the scholarship, and we talked already about, you know, the companies doing background checks and looking at your social media and or colleges, you're about ready to get a scholarship, you don't get access to those scholarships, or you're not going to be on a certain team because they want a good culture fit. You may be the best athlete ever, but if you're not a good culture fit, if you're not a team player, if you're not respectful, then that usually goes against their values. And so there's a number of things that we cover in a lot of these teen presentations, but one is just kind of that whole concept. You are going to be getting a job soon. You're going to be applying for scholarships. You may have an academic or an athletic scholarship. Even the things that you post online. So I actually give examples. There's four different examples I found online of students that their scholarships were revoked after incriminating posts went up, or the college or the university found out about this. One of the girls was at a party, was not drinking, had soda in her cup, but it was in a red Solo cup. Do you know what goes in red Solo cups at parties? It's usually not soda, right? So it was implied that she was drinking. She was going to a very Christian college or was being recruited. And that was not okay. And her scholarship was revoked. She was not able to play softball like she intended to, just because of that one photo. That was a public photo that popped up. And so giving those scenarios, you just hope resonate with them about posting, because then they're also posting everything. And then on the other side, we talk about, you know, what if you want to be an influencer? Okay, you have an open profile, because the guidance is to have a private profile. But if you have a private profile, well, then it's hard to be an influencer and get noticed and grow your following and then make, you know, millions of dollars and get all these product samples sent to you, right? So there is a fine line in showing your life, but not in real time. Showing your life, but not your actual room and your house and those sort of things. You get products sent to you. It doesn't need to go directly to your home. It can go to a PO box in your city or a neighboring city. Just enough separation, because, you know, with anything, there's people out there that want to find you and be your boyfriend or girlfriend. And you're like, nope, I'm not into you, you know? And so that's what we just the more awareness and then steps to, if you want to do this, fine. I mean, your life is online. Here's the steps to do it safely.
Yeah. We just did an episode on EXIF data, and it's bad enough that your images are basically recording your, you know, GPS coordinates whenever you take them, at least where the image was taken. But I was also talking too about, in this case, in the case of influencers and even teenagers in general, who I guess to some extent, everybody kind of thinks they're an influencer, even if they're not really making money on it, because they want to have this public persona that oftentimes is not real, but they're taking pictures of very unique, distinguishable landmarks or things in the environment that people with a little bit of effort can figure out, okay, this is where this person was, this is where they live, on and on. And I've seen that with influencers. They give pieces of information over time that I live in this particular town. And okay, so I remember that. And then, oh, here's this new video showing the person who's basically cycling right down their neighborhood. So now I got the street name. And before you know it, like, hey, I just found out where this person resides. And I'm like, Derry, you guys thinking of this through?
Oh, you know what? That was a really good episode. I mean, thank you for listening to this episode as you listen, but definitely go back to that if you haven't listened to that Exo Theta episode, because that just the fact that most people aren't aware that, or maybe they are and they like it, but when you take a photo, it records the latitude and longitude of where you took the photo, which is super great, right? If it's convenience versus security, convenience in the sense that, oh, I go on a trip or I'm at home, I can click on my home and I can see all the photos taken in my home. Super great. But what happens then, Rich, if I'm texting you a picture of my new dog that I got, and now I just text this to you and the metadata is still in there and now you have my home address? I mean, hopefully you're sending me something great, but I mean, most of the time people don't want that information being sent. So I know you go into it in the episode, but you know, most websites will strip that data, but then who has that data? Does, when you upload the photo, does Facebook store that data? You bet. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
My guess would be yes, but that's how they know where you're at and can tag easily. But there's so many little things and tweaks you can do on your devices and in your life that put those layers on top of each other. So you're not just exposing everything about yourself.
Yeah. My big concern would be on the dating scene when, you take your conversations outside of the app and then you start texting each other those images. And likely, unless you're using an encrypted communications app, you're probably sending them all that information. So
yes,
make sure you know who you're dealing with.
Exactly. Exactly.
Paige, anything else you wanted to cover? Or I guess maybe if people wanted to learn a little bit more about what you do, where they can find you.
Yes. On LinkedIn, I am very active. So find me, Paige Hansen, on LinkedIn. Or check out, you know, if you're interested in either a cyber safety talk or presentation, I do those, as well as my company, Secure Labs, as securelabs.ai.
Perfect. Anything else you wanted to leave us with? Any words of wisdom before we go?
Layers. You know, they're not just for cold weather, right? So it's just all about acknowledging that they're necessary. So I would encourage you this. So next time you go to an online account or website, if it's not asking for an additional piece of authentication where it's texting you a number or you're going to an authentication app, it likely means that you don't have that enabled. So go into the account settings and enable it. I usually say do it as you go. Do it, you know, you can make a list of 100 websites that you have, and it becomes overwhelming and it's not manageable and you won't do it. Do it when you go. Like, I'm probably going to buy something on Amazon today. So I'm going to, if it hasn't asked me for my code, I'm going to go in the account settings and make sure those are on and so on as I go account by account. So that's what I task everyone with, is at least create that layer between you and the fraudster just being able to access any of your online accounts.
That is outstanding advice. Yes. It can be inconvenient, but at the same time, you are right. It's getting a lot easier for these bad actors to find ways to get into your details and your information and your banking. And I've got plenty of stories to tell for another time. So, yeah, good advice. Well, Paige, I appreciate your time. Thanks for doing this. And and thank you for the work that you're doing, because I know this does make a difference.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the platform and having me. I love your podcast. So keep up the great work.
Thanks, Paige. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Privacy Files. If you would like to be on the show, or you know someone who would be a good fit, head on over to privacyfiles.com and submit a guest request. Also, if you're enjoying the content we're cranking out, please consider giving us a 5-star rating in your favorite podcast player. It might seem like a small thing, but it does help others find us. These are people just like you, people who are on their own privacy journey. In our next episode, we'll be talking to former FBI agent Ken Strange. He's the author of the book, A Cop's Son, One G-Man's Fight Against Jihad, Global Fraud, and the Cartels. Ken has lived an adventurous life, from crossing paths with Martin Sheen and Jodie Foster, to going on assignments in remote parts of Latin America, to spending a month walking the Camino de Santiago's 500-mile trek in Spain. This is an interview that will give you one more perspective on the ongoing fight against organized crime. Until next time, don't forget, privacy is a human right.